This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. Texas' 19th congressional seat will open up for the 2026 midterm elections. As KTTZ's Brad Burt reports, the Lubbock Republican is leaving office on a high note.
West Texas Republican U.S. Representative Jody Arrington has confirmed he will not be seeking re-election in 2026. Arrington made the announcement with Fox News on Tuesday. He also released a video announcement on social media.
There's a time and season for everything. And this season is coming to a close. That's why today I am announcing I will not be seeking re-election.
The Plainview native will wrap up a decade in the House, including a recent stint as the House Budget Committee chairman, which gave him a leading role in President Trump's Big Beautiful Bill tax plan that passed earlier this year.
This past year, I had the privilege of leading the most consequential piece of legislation in modern history to make the America First agenda a reality.
McMurray political scientist Paul Fabrizio says several members of Congress are heading for the exit. So far, 37 incumbents, 15 Democrats, and 22 Republicans have said that they will not run for re-election next year. Fabrizio says while Arrington is in a position of power now, things don't look so good for the GOP in 2026.
Most political analysts believe that the Democratic Party is going to win the majority of seats in the House of Representatives in the midterm election next year. So he would go from this position of power to a position of backbench.
Fabrizio says another complication will be the loss of influence for Arrington's party's leader as President Trump becomes a lame duck.
Starting with the election last Tuesday, and it will continue over the next year, more and more politicians are going to start to act as if President Trump is a lame duck. If Jody Arrington has been riding on President Trump's coattails, helping President Trump, he's going to find that the person he's been working for and with is no longer the effective leader and even the center of the political universe.
Arrington's announcement comes just days after his office reported an endorsement from President Donald Trump and after Democrat Kyle Rabel announced his filing to be on the ballot for the District 19 seat next year. Professor Fabrizio says this announcement will likely spark a rush of candidates who will file to be added to the ballot before the December 8th deadline.
It is very, very hard to beat an incumbent. What the research shows is that the time to run for Congress is either when it's an open seat, like we'll have in District 19, or when that person in the congressional seat is up for the first time. Once they've won and won re-election once, it's pretty solid that they're going to be there until they decide to leave. If anybody's out there interested in running for Congress, now is the time. You enter this race as quick as you can.
And he says it'll be hard for any candidate outside of Lubbock to gain traction.
When you look at the district, Lubbock, Abilene, Weatherford, that big district, more than 800,000 people in it, to win that race, you really just need to win Lubbock. There's so many more votes in the Lubbock area than there is in the rest of the district. You could win by just winning Lubbock and getting very, very few votes from any place else in the district.
Arrington did not specify what his next step would be after next year's midterms, but that he would seek a, quote, new leadership challenge.
I'll be looking for the next challenge. I'll be spending quality time with my family, and I will be passing the torch to the next West Texan, because I believe, as our founding fathers did, in citizen leadership. Temporary service, not a career, and it's time to do what George Washington did and to ride off into that big, beautiful West Texas sunset.
Arrington said in a statement Tuesday his plans are to remain focused on, quote, advancing the America First agenda, growing the majority, and delivering for the people of West Texas. Arrington's House District 19 covers nearly all of the South Plains region and into the Texas Panhandle, including the cities of Lubbock, Abilene, and Plainview. I'm Brad Burt in Lubbock.
Last Saturday, the Abilene Freedom Foundation honored veterans and active duty members of the U.S. Armed Services during the Veterans Freedom Parade in downtown Abilene. KACU's Bailey Simon has more.
President Woodrow Wilson established Armistice Day in 1919 to mark the end of World War I and to honor the veterans of that war. In 1926, Congress made November 11th a legal holiday to honor veterans of World War I and to dedicate a day to world peace. Following World War II, President Dwight D. Eisenhower expanded the holiday to honor American veterans of all wars and changed Armistice Day to Veterans Day. Today, America honors veterans with parades featuring floats, service members, and marching bands playing patriotic music, wreath-laying ceremonies at veterans' cemeteries, and school assemblies. Government offices close, and many businesses offer free meals or other services to veterans on the holiday. While Veterans Day is officially on the 11th day of the 11th month, many communities, including Abilene, hold their observances the weekend before. Last year, the Abilene Freedom Foundation took charge of the city's Veterans Day observance, establishing the Veterans Freedom Parade. The celebration includes a car show, and sponsorships help to pay for cash prizes given to parade and car show winners. Proceeds also benefit veterans charities and the program Airmen Home for the Holidays. Steve Rogers attended this year's parade to watch his grandson march.
My dad was served in World War II in the Army. And he was in the Philippines, and he was there from 42 to 45 when the war ended. Our grandson marched in the with the Abilene High Junior ROTC. In fact, he was the commander.
Military enlistment has declined in the U.S. for years, but officials report a notable turnaround in 2024. Still, U.S. officials describe the potential pool of recruits as disinterested. But respect for those who have served is strong. Surveys done by the Pew Research Center in 2024 suggest that 81% of Vietnam-era veterans and 46% of all Korean War and World War II-era veterans feel more respected today than when they served in the military. James King says respect for active military and veterans is much better today than any time in our history.
I think it's just the attitude, and people come to realize that without it, that the military, we don't exist. Those men and women, they're not drafted, they choose to go into it now to serve our country and our nation.
One of the men who chose to serve America is Lee Drummond. The Vietnam draft ended in 1973. Drummond joined the Army in 1974 and served until 1984. Drummond said this year he decided to honor fellow veterans by watching the parade from the side.
In Special Forces, we had a motto, solid professionalism, and we didn't want to be in the limelight. We didn't want to be recognized. We didn't want to be on TV. We just wanted to do our job and be left alone.
Drummond was the acting team sergeant for a U.S. Army Special Forces team in Afghanistan. He says his squad saw a lot of combat action. They were the first unit since Vietnam that used long-range, subsonic, jet-powered strategic bombers called B-52s.
I saw a video of the funeral at Fort Bragg, and I recognized some guys that I knew as young E-5 sergeants and lower enlisted that were still in Special Forces that were at the funeral, and they were now sergeant majors. They were senior NCOs. And that was a pretty good feeling, you know. But, I don't normally come to these events. I recognize my brethren that I left behind and the ones that we had to take to their hometowns for burial detail.
Drummond left the service with disabilities and some medical injuries. He came back to Abilene to work for the post office and retired in 2013. For veterans with physical or other limitations, technology gives them the chance to take part in ceremonies, observances, and parades virtually, whether in their own communities or livestream events at Arlington Cemetery or other locations. Veterans Day gives Americans the opportunity to show gratitude and honor to those who signed up or answered the call to serve, and it gives the nation's veterans a day to pause, remember, and reflect on their own service. I'm Bailey Simon in Abilene.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. The first flight of the B-1 bomber was, get this, 51 years ago. Only two Air Force bases in the country housed that bomber. So the West Texas sky has seen the B-1 since bell bottoms were in style. That bomber has served the country well. But a new state-of-the-art bomber will soon make Abilene home. And what a change it will be. Sean Jackson is vice president and program manager of the B-21 Raider program at Northrop Grumman, and he joins us now. And Sean, I know we had planned on meeting in person, but we've had to pivot because of the government shutdown and a lot of flight delays and cancellations, but we got you on. Thanks for joining us, Sean.
Yeah, George, hey, I really appreciate the invitation and opportunity to really, you know, talk to the people of Abilene and also the men and women of Dyess Air Force Base.
Well, let's talk about that B-21 Raider. Obviously, this is big stuff. What is it about this plane that has you guys at Northrop Grumman so excited?
Yeah, George, you know, we're pretty excited about what we're doing here on the B-21 and our partnership with the United States Air Force. It really, you know, the B-21 is the first sixth-generation bomber. And let me unpack that a little bit. I think everybody's familiar with the B-2 bomber, which flew over 30 years ago. And I think really was highlighted by the work that it did in Midnight Hammer, which was the strikes in Iran about, you know, a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
What B-21 is going to do is really take that, you know, to the next level and really advance the technology that we developed on the B-2, you know, 30 years ago and advance, you know, pretty much in a number of areas. And the areas that I would probably highlight are one is, you know, next generation stealth. You know, the B-21 is going to be able to do things and go places that no other aircraft has been able to do. You know, two is, as we're really designing the airplane in an open architecture sense, which really enables us to continue to modernize and grow the B-21 as it progresses over the years. An example that I like to use is that, you know, everybody, most people have an iPhone or an Android product, and it's kind of seamless when you want to upgrade it. You can put a new app on there and get new technology or new things, you know, almost on a moment's notice. And that's how we're designing the B-21 as well, to be rapidly upgradable, because our adversaries are not static. They're continuing to evolve, and the B-21 is going to need to continue to evolve as well. And then finally, I would say it's really in the sustainment area, which I think is, you know, really will hit home with the men and women of Dyess Air Force Base. And it's really, we want to make the B-21 a daily flyer. We want the men and women in Dyess to be able to fly the B-21 every day and make it affordable. Because as you talked about, that the, you know, the B-1 flew 51 years ago, our goal is for the B-21 to be at Dyess Air Force Base for the next 50 years.
Wow. Well, for anyone out there, by the way, who feels like they've been hearing about the B-21 for years, there is good reason for that. You guys started developing that B-21 back in 2011. This is a long process, and getting a bomber like this into the field is literally a lot of work.
Yeah, it is. And I'll say we've got a, you know, a pretty strong and dedicated workforce across the country. You know, we have, you know, probably over 400 suppliers in 40 states and roughly 78,000 individuals that are working hard every day to make sure that we bring, you know, the B-21 to the United States Air Force, because the B-21 is going to be, I'll say, the cornerstone of our national security for the next, like I said, 50 years. And so it's vitally important that what we're doing and really doing that in partnership with the United States Air Force.
Sean, can you briefly talk about the process from these last few years and where you guys are right now in the process of putting this thing together?
Sure, George. So we started, obviously, you talked about, you know, back in 2011 and really kind of got started in earnest back in 2016 with a contract award to Northrop Grumman. You know, in the first, you know, I'll say the first 5 to 6 years is focused on really the design and using our digital models and tools to design the B-21. And then we really started to transition, you know, into the build and the production aspect of the program. And now we've really transitioned into test. So right now we've got 2 test airplanes that are flying at Edwards Air Force Base in partnership with the United States Air Force. Hopefully a lot of your listeners saw on September 11th, which was a fitting date, we flew the second B-21. We flew it to Edwards Air Force Base. And now also we have the first production airplanes in flow. And those are going to be the first airplanes that we'll deliver, you know, to the 3 main operating bases, which is Ellsworth, Whiteman, and then Dyess Air Force Base.
Well, Dyess and Abilene, as you just mentioned, is one of those 3 slated to get the bombers. And we know South Dakota is first. When do you think B-21s, and I know we're not trying to get you to give an exact day, but when do you think year-wise when we'll see B-1s above the skies here in West Texas?
Yeah, George, I can't talk specifically about dates. What I will tell you is we're working very closely with the Air Force. As they work at each of the various main operating bases to work, you know, say the bed down plans and what, you know, what the Air Force and the Northrop Grumman footprint is going to look like at all those bases. And we're working side by side with them every day to make sure that we're bringing all the tools and technology that Northrop Grumman has to ensure when the B-21 shows up at those main operating bases, that it is a daily flyer. And it is going to be something that the Air Force can use every day, you know, to ensure our freedom for years to come.
Sean, you brought up a really good point earlier. You talked about, you know, your iPhones that kind of update as they go. And I know years ago, doing a story back in my TV days when the B-1 was retrofitted and they had to go in there and take, you know, manual pieces out and put in digital pieces. I guess my question is, since you guys started in 2011 and you're moving forward with this program, have you run into things where the technology has advanced so much that you guys are advancing this plane as you go?
Yeah, Eddie, that's a great point. Is obviously we set up in the Air Force, I'll say, set up a very strong acquisition strategy for B-21 to make sure the requirements stayed very stable from the beginning. And that's really enabled us to stay on cost and on schedule, you know, pretty much from day one. But one thing I'll give the Air Force a lot of credit for is we have early on, we started a modernization program to look at what are the next set of technologies that we need to put on the B-21 to stay one step ahead of our adversaries. And we've been doing that for the last probably 4 or 5 years. And we continue to work very closely with the Air Force and with Air Force Global Strike Command to make sure we understand what are those next set of technologies and we get them on in a very rapid and in a cost-efficient, you know, manner. And so I think it's really a testament, I think, to, you know, the partnership that we've set up, you know, with the United States Air Force. And we were able to do that early on, where I think some programs don't do that and they get a little bit behind the power curve and get a little bit behind in the modernization. And I think we're staying ahead of that on B-21.
Obviously, you know, we're here in West Texas, and one of the big questions that we have is, what does this program mean economically and for the future of this part of West Texas? Do you have any idea? Have you seen any kind of numbers that could tell you what economically this will do for Abilene?
You know, I haven't seen any specific numbers. You know, I think, you know, we're obviously working very closely with the Air Force to figure out what it's, you know, what that footprint is going to be at Dyess. But I think it goes back to, you know, what we talked about a little earlier is that, you know, with the B-21 coming to Dyess, it's going to ensure that Dyess is going to be one of those backbone bomber bases for the next, you know, I'll say 4 or 5 decades. We look at, as we're designing the B-21, looking at similar to what the B-52 is today. And there's probably going to be B-52s flying for almost 100 years. And I would expect that what we're doing on the B-21, that we'll see something similar. And so you'll see B-21s flying at Dyess, you know, for the next 50 or 60 years.
Speaking of Dyess Air Force Base, obviously it is built to house, I can't remember the number of B-1s that are there, 30 or 40. Is there going to have to be some retrofitting done to handle the B-21 Raider?
I think you'll see. I mean, the Air Force is working very closely, you know, with Global Strike Command and our acquisition community to figure out what the footprint's going to be at Dyess, you know, what additional, you know, some military construction is going to be required. We're seeing some of that at Ellsworth Air Force Base, and I would expect that you'll see that at the other main operating bases as well.
As we understand it, the plan is for that B-1 that's, of course, been here since, the 80s to go away. The B-2 that you guys built back in, I believe, in the 90s, that's, as you mentioned earlier, going away. The B-21 is going to be the next generation bomber that is in the United States. That means you've got to build a lot of these planes, don't you?
We do. And obviously, it's key right now is that, you know, we develop a very robust and mature, you know, production process, you know, using, you know, our digital tools and models to reduce the risk and drive down the cost. And by doing that, it's going to enable us, you know, to build a very affordable bomber and really get to where the Air Force wants to go, which is 100-plus B-21.
100-plus B-21. That is a lot of planes in the sky. Sean, is there anything else that we need to know here in West Texas about this B-21 and the work that you guys are doing on it?
I think I would say, you know, a couple things that I haven't got to yet. One, I'd like to wish all your listeners, you know, a happy Veterans Day. As a veteran myself, I appreciate what the Abilene community does to support Dyess Air Force Base, the men and women there, and I know that they really appreciate, you know, your support. I would say also, at Northrop Grumman, we have roughly 1 in 5 of our employees are veterans, and that really drives the mission home here at Northrop Grumman. We are very mission-focused, and I think that's really, a lot of that is driven by a lot of our backgrounds. And so I think that's important to us. And the mission is a primary focus to make sure we're delivering and doing what's right, you know, for the United States Air Force. And finally, I think really, I talked earlier about the partnership that we have with Air Force Global Strike Command and also with our acquisition community. And really, I think our goal now is as we get closer and closer to airplanes showing up at Dyess or B-21 showing up at Dyess is really developing that partnership with the Abilene and the Dyess Air Force Base community. Northrop Grumman is committed, you know, to maturing that partnership with the local community and also, you know, with the local school system. I think one of the things that we think is very important is STEM education. There's a shortage in the United States with respect to STEM education, and really driving that and supporting the local communities and the local schools along those lines. Because someday I'd really hope that somebody in an elementary school or a high school at Abilene, you know, ends up at Northrop Grumman as one of the engineers that's working on the B-21 in the next 20 years.
I love hearing that. Well, you guys are going to be very welcome in this community. There's no doubt that it is very supportive of the Air Force. Sean, thank you for joining us, and thank you for serving our country.
George, I really appreciate it. And once again, happy Veterans Day to all the veterans out there.
Sean Jackson is Vice President and the Program Manager of the B-21 Raider Program at Northrop Grumman, which will soon be arriving in Abilene at Dyess Air Force Base. This is the West Texas Dispatch. Abilene High football is coming off a strong regular season that included only two losses. With playoffs starting Thursday, they look to use that momentum to make a historic run. KACU's Josiah Wannell has more.
In Texas, high school football isn't just a sport. It's a way of life steeped in tradition and defined by expectation. For the Abilene Eagles, a storied program in the heart of the big country, this year has delivered on that promise. The Eagles soared to an 8-2 overall record and captured the District 5A1 title with a perfect 6-0 run. The season started with a familiar win, the Crosstown Showdown against Cooper, a game Abilene head coach Mike Fullen says holds weight for the community.
It's one of those games when you're playing. It's great for the community. You know, it's kind of bragging rights for a year, but you know, the guys grow, they grow up together. You know, these guys played Pop Warner together. So, you know, as far as just the, what it means to the community, to the fan base, it's a big game.
But the team quickly hit a rough patch, losing back-to-back games, the only losses of their season. Coach Fullen scheduled those games specifically to challenge his team and test their vulnerabilities ahead of district play.
Just the level of play, you know, we're playing two 6A schools that we used to be in the district with. You want to make sure that you're getting your team battle tested. You're playing them against really good competition. You know, that just prepares your team to be in battles that you're going to be in district and hopefully that you're going to be prepared for in the playoffs.
Since those early losses, the Eagles focused on consistent development and demonstrated grit, finishing perfect in district play. That grit comes from players like senior outside linebacker Trey Shaw, who leads the team in tackles, and Braden Henry, the versatile running back and quarterback. They say their long, shared history has helped them develop their teamwork.
I feel like we just all win it a lot, like, because most of us are seniors, so it's our last year, so we just giving it our all.
I feel like this team right here, we've all played each other since Little League. So, I mean, being all on one team and really being experienced high school together. I mean, it's like we're trying to go win something big. So, I mean, everybody is in it together. So, like, all of us, we have one goal. So that's what we're going to try to go get.
Going into the playoffs, the team remains locked in on the approach that got them this far. Braden Henry's ability to play multiple positions makes it tough for opposing defensive coordinators. As he prepares for postseason play, Henry says his biggest job now is simple, clock control.
Controlling the clock. I mean, getting our defense more time on the sideline. I mean, trying to take as much time as going to score a drive, anything. Because in playoff, that's what we're really going to need. We're going to have to chew down the clock and give our defense rest. So just being able to do that.
The Eagles will host the El Paso Bel Air Highlanders, which has a district record of 0-6 in the bi-district round. Coach Fullen says no matter the hype or the record, the message for the playoffs remains the same. It's an attrition game, and every play is its own finale.
When you get into the playoffs, you know, you may line up, and again, it's like I tell them, man, we don't have to be the best team in the state, we had to be the best team in the stadium that night. And, you know, that's the thing that I think that when, what I take and try to give to the players, man, all that matters is that game, that night, that play, you know, because there's a finality to everything. And so, you know, there's no reason not to empty your tank and don't take anything for granted. Make sure you enjoy the moment. Make sure you take it all in, and then, you know, don't wish that you don't get up the next morning, man, I could have gave a little more, because there's absolutely no reason not to.
Abilene High has 39 appearances in Texas football playoffs. They brought home 7 state championships, the most recent in 2009. In Texas, a great season means carrying the hopes of a community into the postseason. If you ask the Eagles, they'll tell you they are ready to fly. I'm Josiah Winnell in Abilene.
The U.S. is seeing a decline in international tourists this year, about 9%. The number of Canadian visitors, that's plummeted. But after an initial drop, there has been an uptick in travelers from Mexico. And as KTEP's Angela Conchergo reports, Texas benefits from those visitors.
The area around the U.S. consulate in Juarez is bustling with activity. There are medical clinics, hotels, and restaurants, and agencies helping people prepare their visa applications. The Juarez consulate issues the most U.S. visas in the world, from work permits to family and tourist visas, all for people who want to enter the U.S. legally.
Visitar a mi hermana, a Indiana.
Carolina did not want us to use her full name. She's afraid speaking to the media could affect approval of her tourist visa. She wants to visit her sister in Indiana. Since President Trump took office this year, all applicants, even those renewing their visitor visa, have to show up for an in-person interview. And in October, the cost increased from $185 to $435 because of a new visa integrity fee. On top of that, the entry form tracking arrivals went from $6 to $30. Plus, authorities are checking visa applicants' social media feeds to see if they're critical of Trump administration policies.
Now they want to see your social media, and they want to make sure that you don't have anything that you reposted or that you posted.
Tony Payan researches U.S.-Mexico relations at Rice University's Baker Institute. He says the new requirements are part of an effort to limit all kinds of visas, ranging from students to skilled workers.
I think the basic message is that you're not welcome in the United States. Even tourists who often come and spend money in the country are not welcome.
But visitors from Mexico keep traveling here. According to data from the National Travel and Tourism Office, through August, about 3 million visitors arrived by air from Mexico. That's up slightly over the same period last year. The number of people driving through ports of entry grew by 13% this year, according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Every fall, Raul Vargas's tour company brings busloads of fans from Monterrey, Mexico, to Dallas Cowboys games.
La gente no vienen muy contentos, pero pues sí vienen.
He says these days the people coming are not happy because of their team's mediocre record and the higher cost of visas. Even so, they're among the millions of middle-class Mexicans who visit the U.S. every year to enjoy entertainment and shopping.
This is the outlet shops at El Paso.
Malls in border states like Texas rely on those tourists. At the outlet shops of El Paso, 65% of customers on weekends are from Mexico, says Gina Selecta, director of marketing for this mall and another one in Laredo.
Those consumers are very important to us.
Despite the higher cost and new requirements, she believes Mexican shoppers will show up this holiday season.
They'll make other sacrifices, but making Christmas special for their children and their family members, that's someplace that people just do not make those sacrifices.
It's the reason so many line up at the U.S. consulate in Juarez, hoping for a tourist visa that allows them to fulfill their dream of visiting relatives, seeing a show in Las Vegas, or taking the family to an amusement park. I'm Angela Cocherga in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
It's time for the West Texas Roots. This week we hear from a retired firefighter turned small town mayor. Brian Cunningham tells us about winning outdoor space for his community of Buffalo Gap and his canine right hand, Lady.
We had a struggle getting to keep our park area for our flea market. And we won out a battle, and we've got a nice little park area. We want to improve it and stuff. But, you know, everything takes time. It's not as if we got a large budget or anything. But we've locked in about 4.5 acres in the center of town. It's called the Old Settlers Reunion Grounds. Now, from now on, that belongs to the city. They can't be somebody come along and try to take it away from us. So, and we use it for many great functions, but a couple of them is a chili bowl cook-off, which is wonderful. The fire and ice, and that's another cook-off. And they both, fire and ice, gives us so much money for our fire department. It's really helped us improve the quality of our fire department. And they have all kinds, they smoke meats and stuff like that. And they do a great job of it. And they bring in a lot of money for us. And then the Chili Bowl Cook-Off, that helps Ben Ritchie Ranch, and they really help out a lot. And like we just had Bobcat Caterpillars here in town, they did a, brought out some equipment, let people operate digging holes and plowing, and even had one attachment for their Bobcat that chews up rocks. But it's nice to be able to work with people like that. And then we have a park that people love to be down and around, and I go twice a day to feed the deer. That's my big thing. And we've got a herd of over 40 deer, and that's getting to be the thing. People won't come in to see the deer in the evenings and stuff like that. And of course I've got a little German Shepherd. And she's trained not to chase the deer or bother the deer. She understands it and stuff. That's about the only thing she does when I tell her to. But the rest of the time she thinks I should do what she says. And she's very good at communicating. We operate on the same wing, except she wants to go all the time. And she's not real good on waiting for me to get finished talking somewhere. But I know what she wants, and it makes me look like a great dog trainer when it's her that's training me. I had a 130-pound male German Shepherd, greatest dog I've ever had in my life. But I had also a 14-pound Shih Tzu that, from my daughter and stuff, but I loved her too. Well, she died when he was about 4, and he mourned so hard. It broke my heart. Well, I got a little female Shepherd just to take his mind off of it. And he took to her, that was his dog. And it got to the point I'd try to give her commands and he'd have to come do the command first before she'd do it. And then he passed on, and that's when I started taking her everywhere with me. She's a lady. I'll be riding around, I got a side by side. Decided she liked side by sides and was trying to get into everybody, so I got her one. And we go around and people go, "Hi, lady." They don't say nothing about the bear. And I go by the school and the kids screaming, "It's Lady, it's Lady." Everybody in town, from the wonderful people at our bank to the senior citizens, they all have treats for her. And so she's a brat. But everybody accepts her, you know. And that's kind of the agreement I made when I run for mayor. She goes with me, you know. And now she runs the town. And they announce, "And here comes Lady and the mayor." So that's how it is. I accept it. Then she takes the heat off of it.
Brian Cunningham shared his story while visiting Abilene. If you have a story to tell, whether it's about the history of your community, your family, or West Texas, let us know. Send a message with the subject line "Roots" to info@kacu.org. We'd love to hear your story. This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. KACU is getting ready for the annual Christmas radio play at the Paramount, where, full disclosure, I do work. And the crew is excited to bring back a favorite of theirs and the community's It's a Wonderful Life. KACU's Jordan Herrick spoke with the show's director, Mike Stevens, who has just finished the casting process.
Mike, thanks for making time to tell us about this year's Christmas radio play.
So glad to do it, Joe. What can I tell you?
KACU's Christmas radio play has become part of the holiday tradition for many local families, and this year's play will be It's a Wonderful Life. What makes this one worth bringing back?
It's a Wonderful Life is such a classic. I mean, it's a wonderful story. First of all, based on the original 1947 movie that Frank Capra made, this script has all the items that we fall in love with from the movie. It has George Bailey. It has Clarence. It has Mary Hatch Bailey. There's a couple of characters that we don't see in the play, and I personally miss them. But as it goes to tell this story, it hits all the high points of It's a Wonderful Life. So it really hits those memories of Christmas past.
We've had such great crowds come to see our annual Christmas radio plays in the past, but some people may not have an idea of what a radio stage play is. It's kind of a throwback to the old days of radio performance, right?
Most people are going to be familiar if you say radio plays. Orson Welles and The War of the Worlds on Halloween's Eve, 1939. This is what we're doing. We're bringing a bunch of actors onto stage. They will get up, and at various times they'll come up to the microphones, they'll have their script, and suddenly they're reading in another voice, and you're watching and you're saying, where did that come from? While they're providing those voices, I've also got a couple of Foley artists in the back who are providing all the special effects. So when George is having to run through the snow as he's trying to find Mary before she shuts down the library, how do you have snow on stage? Well, sound effects will have a bag of cornflakes, and one of my Foley artists will be pushing on that bag. And suddenly the audience is hearing George running through the snow. It may take a couple of minutes to start getting into it, but once you buy into the whole effect of it, it's magical.
Yeah. Well, and Foley artists aren't only in radio plays.
It's no.
In all audio, in movies and TV shows.
And originally it's all based on a guy who was the first person to start gathering together sound effects for use in the radio programs and then in movies. But you find Foley artists in all the movies now. Now, granted, they're special effects, and I think it's kind of funny because Tony Palmero, who wrote this play, actually sells the sound effects where you can do that. I think it loses some of the romance to have a guy sitting behind a laptop computer pushing a button. Oh, here's the snowflake sound. Here's the sound of the rock. It's much more fun to have the artist up there making the sound effect.
You just released a cast list, and there's some familiar names, but a different lineup than last time. Can you talk about that?
Every year we've had a slightly different cast, and I enjoy that part of it almost as much as the part of getting to do the play itself. Casting is incredibly difficult for me. I think that's the hardest thing that a director does, because you've really got to look beyond what the person's doing and how they will work with the person next to them. I'm real fortunate with this cast. Ben Eden is going to be leading us off as George Bailey. I've worked with Ben several times on the community theater stage, and he was in our production last year of Texas Christmas Carol. Tony Redman, I've worked with a lot on stage, and he again was in Texas Christmas Carol. He is going to be playing Clarence. Match that with Holly Benty, who is a manager at Monk's, and she's my Mary Bailey. There's a freshness that Holly brings to the stage anytime she does it, and we'll bring that on this. Danny Broyles is going to be brand new to us on this show, and I'm glad that she's going to be here. She's going to be the superintendent of the Angels. She's also going to be Carter, the bank examiner. Vic McCracken played our Ebenezer Scrooge character last year in Texas Christmas Carol. I'm glad to have Vic back on the stage. Yes, he's going to play Mr. Potter. And other people rounding it out, Dalton Martinez, Stephen Eccles, Susan Steele, Abigail Songer, and Sarah Gonzalez, they're going to be my folks on stage bringing these different characters to life. And then I can't forget my Foleys, Mackenzie Corum, and Zola Vessel.
You're not only the director of the play, you also serve on the KACU Community Advisory Board. So you know how important fundraising events like this are for the station.
Absolutely.
Why have an event like this to raise money for this station?
Because, you know, with Christmas, and we think of a play like It's a Wonderful Life, we think of A Christmas Carol. And in Christmas Carol, they do talk about, you know, when, you know, if you could just give to the widows and orphans, the poorer off in our community, it would help us. Scrooge, how much would you put, would you like to be put down for? Nothing. Oh, you wish to be anonymous? No, I wish to be left alone. This is the worst year for that, or worst time of year for that. And frankly, this is a hard year for KACU. We had the rescission back in July. We've had a good fall fundraiser, but the funding needs do not end there. And so this will help KACU close out the year on a strong note.
Mike, thank you for sharing your plans for this year's Christmas radio play.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Joe. It's always fun to talk with you.
The show is Friday night, December 5th, so put it on your calendar. This is a fundraising show to benefit KACU. General admission tickets are $12, and discounted tickets are available for seniors, students, and members of the military. Tickets are on sale now. You can find a link to buy tickets on our website, kacu.org. Or you can buy them at the door. I'm Jordan Herrick.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. Plan to join us and tell a friend. If your friend isn't able to tune in every Wednesday at noon, you can let them know they can subscribe to the podcast. West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and you can find it on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from our team of producers, Heather Claiborne and Jordan Herrick. Special thanks to JC Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.